Today's Taisho is on case 20 in the Mumon Kan, the Umen Kwan. It's entitled The Man of Great Strength. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength cannot lift his legs? And he also said, it is not the tongue he speaks with. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all of his stomach and intestines. But alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. Why? If you want to see pure gold, you must see it through fire. Lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now someone write the last line here. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful day at the end of the summer to practice this beautiful path of Zen. I want to thank you very much. Today is the end of the summer. You know? Many of you are in school, your students, or your some of you teach also. And all of that beautiful summer is coming to an end, and now we're going to get back into it. I don't know about you, but fall semester for me is always very challenging. This last week we finished up a very busy week. This is some of you know that I run the writing program here at Rutgers, and I spent all summer interviewing potential teachers in our program. And I advertise in the New York Times, and several times. And you wouldn't believe it. A little ad in the New York Times, it's like a half an inch by an inch. You know, unbelievable. That's like $4,000. So we advertise several times. So we spend about $10,000 on advertising just for two ads in the New York Times. And we ask for people who would like to teach writing at the university level, and they have to have an MA or a PhD or a degree in science. And I get hundreds of letters, literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds with writing samples and so on. And then I interview people all summer long. I interview more than 100 people. And all of those people that I hire, maybe 50 people or something like that, come to the orientation that we have the week before school starts. So this last week has been the week of our orientation, and we spend a lot of time planning for it. But the thing is, it's very hectic. You know, everybody. There's always some problems. There's always like last minute resignations, or there's some snags. And we have to cancel sections and open sections. And we have quite a few people teaching in the writing program, more than 200 people. So running this whole thing, which serves about 11,000 students a year, is quite an enterprise. And one of the busiest weeks of the year is the last week we just had. So that's the beginning of the semester for me. And then once school starts and everything starts going, it's just like running a race. It's like somebody says, on your mark, get set, go. You know, boom. And we just start running as fast as we can and try to get to the end of the semester. You know? So that's sort of a university teacher's life. And it's it has its stresses, right? You know, has its stresses. And people who don't understand, like the university, think it must be very peaceful and calm. My father was in the military, and he always thought of the university as this place that must be just like heaven, right? And I guess for him, it probably was like heaven. You know, he had gone to college, and for him, college was this beautiful place where there were trees and grass, and people talked about ideas. And then he was in the service, you know. And my father fought in World War II, which was probably like being in hell, right? You know, he was on a ship, the Atlanta, that was blown up in the Pacific Ocean, and only a few people survived, like only a couple hundred people out of 1,000 people or something survived. So he had many difficult experiences in the war, and I think he always thought of college as like this island of sanity. And I think he always thought of university professors as like monastics, you know, doing their quiet work, you know, contemplating their big ideas. And a lot of people think of it that way, but actually it's not so much like that. It can actually be very much like a pressure cooker, you know, really. You might not think so, but it's actually, there are a lot of demands. I'm not trying to sell you on what a hard life I have. But I'm trying to make the point that a lot of ways of living in the modern world are a pressure. There's a lot of pressure. And it doesn't really matter what you do, you know, actually. People have a lot of pressure to deal with. You know, when you get a job as an assistant professor, an assistant professor is like a beginning professor. You're under a lot of pressure to publish articles. And if you don't publish articles at the end of your time at this university or college, you'll be fired, basically, and you'll have to look for a new job. So it's an emotionally difficult, I mean, I guess everybody gets fired, but you put a, sooner or later, you know, I was reading the other day, the average engineer loses his or her job 5 times in a career. So people who are very good engineers get fired all the time, or their job just gets shut down. I was reading that, this is something I read quite a while ago, but I guess that they did a study of people who work for NASA, and they found that they have a higher rate of heart attacks if a project is successful than if it isn't successful. Isn't that interesting? And you think, now why the heck is that, right? You know, they launch a space shuttle, everything goes according to plan, and people start having heart attacks because they know they're going to get laid off. See, isn't that interesting? If it's successful, they don't need so many people, and you know, so they recruit and hire all these specialists, they get in on this project, the thing goes up in the air, and if it doesn't come crashing down, it's like, very good work, you're fired, you know. So they have pressure, right? You know, and you could get out of school with an engineering degree, and you could be a superb engineer, you know, but the project you're working on might be over, and then they just say, well, thank you and good luck to you, and suddenly you don't have a job. I have a friend, my next door neighbor, Fidel is his name, and he works for a medical technology company. And he's been working for them for about 10 years. He bought a house, and he and his partner bought a house next door to Barbara and me. And basically his company was bought by another company, and they downsized, and he lost his job, and he has to move to he and his partner are moving to South Carolina, and basically his partner is an engineer who finally created his own firm in order to stop getting fired, and now Fidel is unemployed at this moment, but he's trying to get into another firm down there, you know. So these two people, Fidel and Keith, are really wonderful people, very nice, very sharp, real, really dynamic, hardworking guys. But this is life. Pressure, you know. And if you're a young professor, you're trying to keep your job. You know, you have to publish, and you have to give these papers. And when you publish your papers, you know, it's not as though everybody goes and listens to your talk and goes, "Thank you, that was so wonderful. You know, what fresh ideas." You know, that's not how academics behave. You know, a lot of the time when you present your ideas, people feel threatened, so they try to shoot them down. You know, and if you say anything new or a little bit different, you know, people can get very upset. You know, and people can get upset if you just didn't, if they're doing work in the same area and you didn't mention them in your paper. Really, you know, that's true. A friend of mine years ago was trying to get something published, and his article got one acceptance and one rejection. The one acceptance, one person read it and said, "This is wonderful," and the other person said, "This is trash, you know, don't publish it." So the editor didn't know what to do, and anyway, ultimately my friend found out that the person who rejected it was upset because my friend hadn't cited him, hadn't put him in a footnote and said, "Professor X has a wonderful idea about this." You know? So this kind of thing goes on all the time. And then even after you get to tenure, you know, which everybody thinks is such a wonderful thing, you know, you're under a lot of pressure also to continue to go and give papers and publish and write your books. And then you can get, you know, you're under a lot of pressure because you write a book, and you could spend 5 or 6 years on this book, and then it could be reviewed by somebody who doesn't like it, and that might be the only review that ever gets written. So you know, you spend 5 or 6 years on this book, you publish it, you think, okay, you're going out into the world, you know, we'll see what happens. And then you read some review of your book, and they don't like it very much. They say it's not very, you're not very bright, or something like that. You know, and it really hurts your feelings, and so this can happen to people, right? And pressure, right? I think probably any job carries a lot of pressure with it. My brother started a business about almost 30 years ago. He was a biology major, and he couldn't really get a job in his field. He didn't really want to go back to graduate school right away. He wanted to live a sort of ordinary civilian life. And so he got a job working for a very nice man who was in the Asian carpet business. He was a Syrian, and Mr. Shia was his name. He was a very nice a Syrian man, and he hired my brother to work in his store. And my brother got very interested in Persian carpets and Central Asian carpets. And instead of going back to graduate school, he worked in this business, this import business, Indian and Pakistani carpets also. He just came to love these beautiful carpets, and he worked his way up from just somebody who carried the carpets out of the truck to partner in the business. And eventually he bought out Mr. Shia, but my brother, you would think, well, he has it made. You know, I go to my brother's store, it's this big store, he sells he's not alive anymore, but he would sell these beautiful carpets, and the carpets themselves are just gorgeous, you know, and they're so expensive that his clientele, his customers, are really, you know, no matter what happens to the economy, these people have so much money, you know, so they would come into his store and say, "I'll have one of those, you know, and they're, you know, $25,000 a piece, you know. So my brother's clientele were very wealthy, so you would think he had it made in the shade, you know. Beautiful store, nice location. He had trucks. He had 3 delivery trucks for his, you know. And so you think he has it made, but you know, one day he was telling me that he was out mowing the grass, and his accountant drove up, And the accountant got out of the car and walked over and said, "Peter, we have to talk." And my brother said, "What's wrong?" And the accountant says, "You lost $30,000 this month." And my brother said that it was like in the movies. His legs became like rubber and began to just, they gave out under him, you know. So my brother just, he didn't quite faint, but his legs gave out on the grass, you know. And so he stayed in business, you know, he just had a bad month, you know. You know, this is part of modern life, is having to deal with pressures. You know, we set very high goals for ourselves. You know, we're all very highly motivated, and we all want to achieve all kinds of things in life. And one of the costs of doing that is pressure. You know, but I think Zen can help you a lot with your pressure. You know. I think it can help you in a superficial way, and then I think it can help you in a deeper way. You know, so first I want to talk about the superficial way. You know, meditation is like the number two most effective stress release in the short term. And this is really well documented. So, you know, basically, people who have stress should do two things. First of all, they should get exercise. Exercise is number one stress release. So if you have a lot of problems with stress, you should probably, you know, go for a walk every day or go for a run, take up jogging or something, so that you can get some of that excess energy out of the way and clear your mind of that anxiety, you know. It would be a good idea to meditate. You know, meditation is very good for stress release in the short term. A lot of people do try meditation, and it doesn't necessarily help at first. You know, when you come in to sit, if you're very stressed, it's not as though as soon as your bottom hits the cushion, all the stress goes away. That's not going to happen. But when you sit on the cushion, if you do watch your breath and you keep your back straight and you focus on the breath, you will notice that even if during the whole sitting period you're very, very tense, you know, and you're having a lot of thoughts and you're struggling quite a bit, probably when you get off the cushion you'll notice you're still more relaxed. And I see this all the time. I will ask people after the sit, "How did your sit go?" And they'll say, "Oh, not very well, you know, I have a lot of stress and there are a lot of thoughts in my mind," and so on and so on. And then I'll say, "Well, how do you feel now? Do you feel more relaxed?" And they'll, "Yes, and I do." So meditation can really help you just sitting quietly or arranging the body properly, watching the breath. These things are really inherently therapeutic. You know, if you're breathing with your hara, your dantian, squeezing and releasing, at the end of that breath, there's usually like a little moment where the mind is still, and if you keep returning to that, no matter how stressed you are, you know, you'll feel a little better. So Zen can help you if you're having stress, you know, just in a very superficial way. It's like medicine. And as I say, there's all kinds of stress. People even have stress on their vacations because they're not working, you know. When I was in college, I couldn't wait to get out of college, and I wanted to go out west and do backpacking. And you know, so I was in college and I was studying, and then I got my diploma, and I had imagined that this would be like being free out of jail, right? You know, I would get my diploma, and I had given myself like a year off to save some money and go out west and backpack. And I just thought, this is going to be heaven. But you know what? As soon as I had my degree in my hand, I began to feel stressed because I didn't have a job, you know? And it really was heavy. I began to feel very nervous because all my friends were going to their jobs, and I thought, oh my God, what's going to become of me, you know? am I just going to be a bum? You know, am I just going to be some hiking bum? You know, and so actually, I couldn't see into the future. It's too bad. I could have just relaxed, you know, because it all turned out okay. But at the time, you know, that uncertainty. I didn't have any more exams. You know, I didn't have to, you know, carry on a part-time job while I was trying to get through my studies, and so, you know, I suddenly had a very easy life. But there was still like this undercurrent of stress. You know, even I know people who are stressed on their vacation because they're not working and they're worried. And if you ask them, well, what were you worried about? I said, well, I didn't know. I was worried because I didn't know. You know, what to be worried about. You know, so stress is very interesting, very complicated. You know, and as I say, you know, you could jog, you can run, you can maybe lift weights. That's not as good as a cardiovascular workout, you know, for cutting stress. But and then you can sit, and all of those are wonderful. But you know, that's like giving a patient medicine to alleviate immediate symptoms, but it's not like treating the disease, you know. And this is quite widely done. In Japan, for example, people, I think, actually misuse Zen quite a bit. So there's a lot of companies that will send their junior employees to a Zen monastery. And the poor people, you know, you can imagine. You know, you want to be a banker, and you have some boss who decides it would be really good for you to go to a Zen monastery. And partly, it's not really to relieve stress, it's to make you a better worker. And the idea is Zen is going to make you a better worker. So you have to do Zazen, and if you move, somebody's going to hit you with a stick, and you learn to habits of self-denial, and so on. And this is thought to make you a better worker. So you're sort of like a banker monk, right? You're going to work 20 hours a day, and you're not going to complain, and so on and so on. And also one of the reasons people send their employees to temples in Japan is so that their employees can learn how to deal with pressure and cultivate a calm mind. This goes back really to the samurai period, you know, where in Japan a samurai who were often having to go to battle. And probably had bad odds, you know, not very good odds of survival, would do Zen to calm their minds, and so they wouldn't run away on the battlefield, you know. So, you know, actually, the samurai had very high. I was reading something the other day, actually, about samurai, and it was an economist was looking at the samurai class in Japan, and he said the odd thing was they had such a high mortality rate, you know. And I don't think it's odd at all, you know. They're out there with their swords, and a lot of them got killed, you know. So they would do Zazen to steel their will so they could go into battle. So. Now, my feeling is that that's really bad, personally, you know. It's not just that the Buddha said to practice ahimsa, you know, nonviolence, and that, you know, being a warrior, a Buddhist is kind of a contradiction in terms, actually. That's not the problem for me. I mean, that's part of it, of course. But it's that you're not really using Zen to treat the disease. You're using Zen to make people sicker. You know, when you send people to do Zazen, and you just say, "Here, alleviate your stress so you can go back into the battle," you're not really treating the disease. See, just symptoms. So I think it's worth asking where our stress comes from, see? And I think that's a complicated issue. You know, I think a lot of stress comes from deep fears that we have about, you know, our own worthiness, you know, basically. I was always really impressed by Genki Roshi. You know, Genki Roshi was a strange man, if I may say so. My first teacher, he was a very strange guy in more ways than I can tell you in this time period. You know, when we when he came from Japan, we decided we were going to build a temple, and we looked for land, we looked for a property that would be appropriate. We found a beautiful place that was on the edge of a national forest, and you could, from the place where we built the meditation hall, you could see for almost 100 miles. I'm not exaggerating. It was breathtaking. That part of Washington State where we bought our property was the eastern part of the state, so it's more like New Mexico or Colorado. It's not rainforest. It's like high desert. So there were trees around the zendo, but when you looked out over the hills, over the mountains, sloping down into the valleys were very dry. And so there were very few obstructions, and you could just see for 100 miles. It was extraordinary. And we had very ambitious plans. One of our members was an architect, and he drew up all these plans. And so we borrowed quite a bit of money and to buy the land, and then we started this building project. And we really wanted our teacher, Genki Roshi, to become like a fundraiser. And we really hoped that he would start doing like PR events, you know, like lots of PR events. So our dream was that we could basically start marketing Genki Roshi, see, so we could raise money. And this happens all over the country. If you get Tricycle Magazine, a lot of the time you'll open one of the covers and you'll see a picture of a Lama X or Zen Master Y, a big smile, right? And they'll be like, you can get the records and the tapes, or the CDs now. They don't have tapes anymore. You can get CDs or, they'll visit different cities. So you'll hear that Lama so-and-so is coming to such and such a city. And this is like, the person could be a wonderful teacher, but basically they're marketing the teacher to raise money. This is how you often build a temple. And this is what we wanted to do with Genki Roshi. We wanted to have like a photo ops and PR. We wanted Genki Roshi to go out into the community and start being charming and affable so we could make some money, see? And lots of people got into this. We had a couple people in our group who were like in public relations for companies. And they sort of drew up a little plan about how we were going to market Genki. Really, I'm not kidding. And it was, the whole thing was a disaster, actually. Because Genki didn't want to be marketed, And he didn't, sometimes he would have to give a talk, like we'd organize some kind of a public event, and he would just say some things that were so uninspiring, I hate to say it, but they weren't that interesting. He wasn't a comedian, he didn't get up there, and the Dalai Lama is like a born comedian, I've seen him speak on numerous occasions. He's incredibly funny. He has all, if he didn't turn out to be the Dalai Lama, he could have been a very good stand-up comedian, because he has a good sense of timing, he understands American humor, he's disarming, it's just, he can be ironic, He's very funny and irreverent. The Dalai Lama can be very irreverent, So he's very good at those kinds of, and Genki was just terrible at those kinds of opportunities, And I couldn't understand why. I just thought, why won't he put himself out there? Why won't he make the effort to be like this to be a presence, to be a person on a public stage, And anyway, the whole thing fell apart, and it never happened. And Genki was just not marketable. And I had a chance to know him, I think, pretty well. And this was like a mystery to me. Why won't you sell yourself. You know, why won't you sell yourself? You know, and but the more I got to know Genki Roshi, the more I began to realize that he was. I don't want to put this the wrong way, but he was totally independent of the approval of others. See, I think such people are extremely rare. In other words, most of us are like dependent on the approval of others. Yeah. In other words, you know, I got to be a good student because teachers helped me to be a good student by giving me their approval. So, you know, when I was in about the 10th grade, I was a terrible student. In the 9th and 10th grade in high school, well, I'm sorry, 8th and 9th grade, I was a terrible student. I would just get like C's. And my parents were very alarmed. My father would come in and see, you know, talk to me, and he'd get the report card and he'd go, "Kurt, with grades like this, you'll be a ditch digger. Do you want to be a ditch digger?" You know, I mean, I was only like 11. I thought, what does that mean? You know, I have no, like, should I? You know, a ditch digger, that was the worst thing in the world, right? As I've said before, you know, I actually used to work construction. I've actually dug ditches, you know, and it's not so bad, you know, actually, it's not so bad. But it was terrifying in my father. You'll be a ditch digger, you know. So I was getting these C's and even D's, you know, it was just like scary. My parents just didn't know what to do. That's it, no television for you, you know, and that didn't work. So anyway, I wound up taking Algebra 1, and I was terrible at Algebra 1. I just couldn't figure out algebra, you know. So I failed like almost the first half of the semester. But then in the second half of the semester, I had a very kind teacher. This woman said, "I'm not going to let you fail Algebra 1," and I really wanted her to let me fail, you know, but she wouldn't do it. And so she worked with me, and it was like I couldn't escape, you know. Finally, I actually figured out how to do algebra, and I actually sailed through algebra. I literally, the second half of the semester, I got like straight A's. And I figured out how to study. See, I didn't know how to study or apply myself. And I figured out how to do that. And then, you know, I began to enjoy being thought of by others as smart. See, I began to really enjoy that. So I began to like study seriously, and I began to enjoy having my teachers single me out for being smart. And so I actually got like tremendously good grades in high school, and I put myself under a lot of pressure to get good grades because I wanted to be approved of by my teachers. I didn't care what my parents thought. You know, they just seemed to me like these clueless people. You know? but my teachers seemed to know what was what, you know? And so I respected my teachers, and nothing made me happier than they'd go, "Well, you know, why did Lincoln write the Emancipation Proclamation?" And I'd stick my hand up, "Kurt?" Yes, and I had the answer, see? And I got to be terrible, you know, like, no matter what the question, I always had my hand up. And the teacher would say, "Can somebody else please take a crack at this?" You know, but no, me. Right? See. And I got really into being smart. I wanted people to think I was smart. You know, and it was like an addiction almost, right? And so when I got to college, same thing. You know, I began to take English courses. And in English courses, I could interpret the heck out of things, you know. So if somebody gave me a poem, I could read it, you know, every which way, you know. And I really enjoyed being smart. And then I remember I took a philosophy course. And it was such a shock to me because, you know, I know how to do literary criticism, but I don't know how to do philosophy, you know. So I took this philosophy course, and philosophy is very different from literary criticism. In an English course, when you read a poem, they want to see what you can do with it. They want to see independent thinking. But in a philosophy course, they don't want to see independent thinking. See, they never want to see it. What they want to see is, can you explain the philosopher's way of thinking. So if you're reading Plato, you don't get to have an interpretation of Plato. You just have to tell the teacher what was Plato's argument in the symposium, right? You take the teacher through it. And if you do that well, in an inventive way, you can get an A. But I didn't know that. I thought you could critique Plato, right? So I did a critique of Plato and I failed. And the teacher said to me, are you in college? You know, are you in college? Yeah, yes, I'm in here in this university. He said, well, I don't see how any intelligent person could have written this paper. He actually said that to me. So that was like my last philosophy course, actually, really. See? And I never took another philosophy course because I didn't want to risk being thought stupid. And same thing with science courses. You know, I stayed away from science courses because I was afraid that I couldn't be intelligent in a science course. So what I'm trying to get to is that, you know, for me, the motive really wasn't learning. The motive was being thought of as smart. That's so human, don't you think? So much of what we do is tied in with this deep hunger to be approved of by people we respect. See? And now you can say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Well, there's nothing wrong with respecting people. But there is something wrong with not living your life, see, because you're addicted to certain kinds of success. Not success you've defined for yourself, but success that somebody else has defined. You know, so, I mean, when I got to graduate school, I would meet these people who were in the spell of certain professors. So when I got to graduate school, there was a professor named Hazard Adams. I didn't know you could have the name Hazard, you know. That was his name, Hazard Adams. And he was, I would say that he was a very intimidating person, let me just say. And he would, if you didn't, he would shut you right down if he didn't think you were saying something intelligent. And he could be rather, he wasn't cruel, you know, he wasn't cruel, but he was just like, you know, if he didn't have time for you if you weren't very smart. So everybody wanted to be smart in his class, everybody. And people desperately, they fell over themselves to be approved of by Professor Adams. And you know, you would even hear them speaking like Professor Adams. They'd start sounding like him and pronounce it. Really, I'm not kidding. You'd hear people pronounce words the same way he did, you know. He had kind of a curious Midwestern accent. So these students started saying, he would say, idea. And you would hear students say, idea. Right? You mean an idea? You know, but, you know, they pick it up. It's like they started, almost like a, anyway, this is very human. I'm not trying to be contemptuous. You know, years ago, I noticed when the Dalai Lama came to Seattle, he had these glasses that had, he wore glasses with a black plastic top. And I began to run into people who were Tibetan Buddhists, and they all had glasses with a black plastic top, right? And in fact, Richard Gere had glasses like that for a long time, yeah? So it can happen in any context, right? But I think one of the reasons we have stress is that we're not doing things for the right reason, right? So it isn't natural. See, I think Zen meditation is all about being true to your true nature. You know, there's a self that you have created in your life to please other people. And that's the self that you want to be smart, that wants to be smart or rich or dynamic, you know, whatever. But you also have another self that has no birth and no death, you know, and that has no beginning and no end. That's what we call in Zen your true nature, no face. See, no face. When we sit in Mu Xin, we're face to face with our true nature. And eventually, the boundary between ourselves and our true nature disappears. You know, somebody like Genki Roshi was really rare because he wasn't trying to be approved of by others. And I think he had a very, very beautiful life because he wasn't worried that he wasn't, you know, he wasn't worried about being in the right place, in the right time, and doing the right thing. I really believe that you meet such people. They're quite rare in this world, and they're very deeply free. Psychologically, they're just not trying to be anything but their true nature. You know, there are people. You know, I think maybe we learn to live this way. You know, sometimes we learn. People who don't do Zen learn to live this way. It's like, I have a friend who's an artist, painter, and. She's an incredible painter, and she's made very little money in her life, and she's gone through all the changes, all the mental games. We all play these mental games, right? You know, she got out of art school, and her uncle was a very well-known artist, so she kind of thought she was going to go his route, right? And indeed, she has talent to burn, right? She's just a fantastic draftsman. She can just, her lines are magnificent, color, you know, you name it. And, you know, she probably got out of art school thinking, you know, I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to be somebody. And maybe she thought, you know, she could see in 20 years there'd be the American Art Magazine feature on Sidney Sutman. Right, you know, the next Georgia O'Keeffe, that kind of thing. And you know, she did these incredible paintings, and she'd have these shows, but the paintings didn't always sell, and you know, it was hard sometimes to get galleries to carry her stuff. She wasn't like trendy, you know. And so she went through all of this unhappiness for a long time, very stressed, very depressed, went through depression. Because, you know, I think she was painting for the wrong reason. You know, the reason you become an artist isn't so you wind up in art magazine, American Art Magazine. If that's your reason, you're going to be so unhappy. See, you're trying to be somebody, and that's a big mistake, in my opinion. Please don't try to be anybody. I'm not saying don't try, but if you want to be a painter, paint, and let go of your fantasies about being famous painter, because that's so much chance. You know, one year painters, you know, realistic painters are in, and the next year it's abstract painters, and the next year it's, you know, so you can't control, you know, public taste. That's impossible to predict or control, because it's just capricious, you know, it's based on making money. It has nothing to do with making art, you know. So you know, if your goal is to be great, you know, again, there are people who have written books. You know, every once in a while, I'll pick up a book and I'll read it by an unknown writer. My wife often finds these. She's in the book business. She'll find some novel by some guy I've never heard of. There's this guy. She gave me a novel by this guy Hergesheimer, I think is his name. And I didn't finish it, but I was so amazed. I thought, who is this guy? You know, he's like this American writer from about 100 years ago. He was a fantastic writer, and I'm sure you've never heard his name. He's totally forgotten, you know? And yet he was a great writer. I think that there's a way to live. I think a lot of our stress comes from not being true to our true nature, not living with the true nature, but trying to be approved of by others. And I think it actually makes things so hard, it finally makes it so hard to do anything well. You know, I think finally, you know, you're pulled in different directions. You know, people, you'll often hear people say, I'm pulled in different directions. You know, I'm pulled in different directions. I have two minds about this. This means not being true to your true nature, right? You know, I want to do this, but I want to do that. How's that possible? You know, usually that kind of self-contradiction comes from not being clear about yourself, about who you really are, right? So Zen is about living in the mushin, living in blankness. And when you're doing something deeply from mushin, you should feel joy and a kind of freedom, right? I have a friend of mine who is like a very good literary critic. I mean, he's really great. And I don't think he cares what anybody thinks about his work. He just loves it. And his passion is so clear. You know, and he does get attacked. People attack him all the time, but he doesn't care. He's really indifferent to approval or disapproval. He's you know, there's a word for this in Chinese. It's the Tao. Being in the Tao. You know, sometimes you feel so alive in the midst of great stress. You know, you can be in a job that's high pressure. You know, you meet these people, the job is high pressure, you know, every day it's a madhouse, and yet they just seem to sail through it. You know, and you do meet these people, you know, maybe they go home and they take some kind of a stress release drug, but it may be that they found a way to live with it, you know, by being true to their true nature. You know, it's possible to be right in the midst of chaos and be totally calm and joyous because you're doing what your true nature tells you to do, you know? And that's what Zen is all about, is getting in touch with that true nature, you know? So, you sit on the cushion, you come in to sit. The other day I was sitting, and I've been really tired myself. We had Sashin, and then we had this very busy week at my job. And on Thursday night, I was so tired. It was astounding. I mean, literally, I was so tired. I have to confess, I fell asleep during the Thursday night sit. You know, and you didn't notice, I'm sure, because I've been doing this for 30 years. I can sleep sitting up, you know, and nobody can tell. Really? I sometimes fall asleep at home, you know, sitting up, and it's like, oh my God, you know. So I don't fall over or anything. So I was totally asleep. It was like, you know, I would sort of get, wait a minute, what time is it, you know, and ring the bell, you know. But I could hardly open my eyes when everybody turned on the lights because I had been fast asleep. I was so tired. So anyway, you know, Friday morning, I got up and I sat. And, you know, it was like sitting in this dead blankness for a while. But then all of a sudden, it was like this little boop. It was like a E.T., you know, when E.T. dies on the operating table, you know, and the little kid cries. Did you ever see the movie E.T.? That was probably before you were born. I'm not sure. Anyway, yeah, I'm out of fresh cultural references because for me it will always be 1985. You know, I was dead, let's put it that way, and I had no energy, and everything was dark. And all of a sudden, there's like this beep, 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 and I could just feel it coming back. You know, it was like this energy, you know? It was just like, all of a sudden, here comes the current. I swear, I'm just telling you how it is, you know? I'm just being totally straight with you, you know? All of a sudden, it was like a little switch came on. And it was just like a rush of energy and a rush of joy, right? And I felt like I am so glad to be alive, right? Just sheer existence is so great, right? Just sheer existence is so great. That's living with your true nature, right? That's what Zen is all about, you know? Finding that joy, that sense of connection and energy, And I think people are, so many people I know are like taking antidepressants all the time and so on. I think, and there's nothing wrong with that. If you need antidepressants, please take them. But for the long term, maybe it has to do with how you're living your life. You know, what good is it if you succeed in your goals, but you're miserable, right? You know, so many people, you know, they get that, they make their million, they get their books published, and they're still unhappy because they're not living the right way, you know. When we sit on the cushion, you know, you enter Mushin, pretty soon you begin to see your own bullshit, right? Be a bit vulgar about it, you know. It's very hard for people to be honest with themselves. I'm going to wrap it up, just a few more minutes. You know, I had a friend of mine, and I've talked about him before. His name was John, and he's been married 3 times, and he's had 4 long relationships. And again, if that's how you live, I'm not criticizing, you know. But, you know, John's second wife was named Bobby, and I thought she was a very nice person, and she was always very good to me, and she was stunningly beautiful, by the way. She was like an ex-model and actress, and a very intelligent woman, just like, it was like the whole package. And her husband was a neuroscientist at the University of Washington. And, you know, I began to notice that my friend John was criticizing her all the time. And then I would hear that they were having arguments all the time, and then pretty soon I discovered that John was having an affair with another woman, and then he married that woman. And years later, well, anyway, the point was, you know, most people would say, well, of course, he was unhappy in his relationship, and then he married, and he had all these arguments. He was unhappy because he had all these arguments. And then, because he was unhappy, he married this woman. But I don't think that's how it happened at all. I think he met this woman, he wanted to marry her, and he began to invent reasons for not liking his current wife. I believe that. You know, and years later, actually, he said to me, you know, I could have stayed with Bobby. You know, it's like, yes, indeed. You know, I think we invent reasons for doing things, you know, and often they're not good things. So I don't think we can trust the thinking mind. I really don't. I think the thinking mind isn't always honest. So when you say to yourself intellectually, what do I want to be? What do I want to do? See, I don't think you can trust that mind. Because that's the mind that's trying to live up to all kinds of fantasies. That's the mind that wants to be the smartest kid in the class. That's the mind that wants to, you know, whatever. So you sit on the cushion and you face Mushin, see? And at some point, you know, that mind just withers away. And it becomes possible to be a little bit truthful with ourselves. You know, and that's so rare. And then, you know, it's possible actually to begin to be free. You know, my friend, my teacher, Genki Roshi, is somebody nobody has ever heard of. See, nobody. You know, if I say Genki Roshi to somebody, they don't know Genki Roshi from anybody. You know, he's not the Dalai Lama, you know. And yet, you know, he was the freest person I ever met. I think that's, you know, Americans are terrified of not being liked and not being known. You know, we're so terrified that we'll get on TV and humiliate ourselves. And at least we look like idiots, but at least people see us, right? You know, this is so sad, right? We're addicted. And so depression, and et cetera. But, you know, to be a totally unknown person, in I think the modern world is like the worst fate you can suffer, right? That's like, oh, he's an utterly unknown, he's a nobody. See, you know, for thousands of years, Buddhist monks and nuns have tried to be nobody. See, they've understood this is a very free condition. You know, you can be nobody and work at a bank, you can be nobody and be a scientist, you can be nobody, you can go in and pretend to be somebody. But if in your heart you're nobody, you're really free. It's a wonderful way to live. So, you know, something told you this morning to get up and come here. I don't think it was the thinking part of your mind, you know. You didn't sit down and say, you didn't get up and go, what are the chances I might have a good sit today? 50-50? I'll do it. I'll go. Right? You know? Well, I read an article the other day that said, meditation helps you to be more successful. I'll go. Maybe I'll be more successful. See? You didn't do that. You didn't really have an intellectual reason for coming. You just came. Something deep inside you, we would say in Zen, your true nature said, get up, see. And you sat on the cushion. I think that's so wonderful. So thank you for being true to your true nature. Why is it that a man of great strength cannot lift his legs? See, are you doing something because your true nature told you to do it? Or are you doing something because you think it should, you know, others want you to do it? See, because somebody will approve of you. Now, when people are paralyzed, it's because they're not acting from their true nature. See? So, a person of great strength, doesn't matter how strong you are, if you're not acting from the right place, you can't even lift your leg, see? But if you're in touch with the true nature, it's like the power of the energy, the life of the universe is your life, see? Why is it that a man of great strength cannot lift his legs? Lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. See, if you live in deep mushin and you act from your true nature, you kick up the ocean. Lowering his head, you look down on the fourth jhana heaven. That's the highest heaven. So if you live in mushin, you look down on heaven. See? Nice, huh? There's no space vast enough for his body. This world is my body. This whole world is my body. Now somebody write the last line here. You have to write it yourself. You have to find your true nature. Nobody can do it for you. Nobody can tell you what it is. So please find it.